lot of cities are able to acquire some pretty funky nicknames. In the USA, we have the Big Apple, the Windy City, and Sin City. Europe has Prague, the City of a Thousand Spires, or Dubrovnik, the Pearl of the Adriatic. And last week on this podcast, we visited Rome, the Eternal City. So what about Paris? Well, there are few cities that are as lit up as the French capital. Nearly all of the churches, statues, fountains, national buildings, bridges, and monuments are illuminated. Every night, the Champs-Élysées is aflame, and the Eiffel Tower, the most famous landmark in Paris, shines like a beacon thanks to 20,000 light bulbs. So it's probably not surprising that the nickname for Paris is the City of Light. Except that is not how Paris got its nickname. And wouldn't it be better if Paris had a nickname that had something to do with the romance of the city? How about its high culture or haute couture? Or maybe its epic sewer system? What? Hello, and welcome to Snapshots from Europe Travelogue. I'm your host, Brian Unger, providing the historical, cultural, and geographical backstories for some of the greatest destinations in Europe to help you get a fuller appreciation for these places when you visit. Paris is a fascinating, complex, aesthetically pleasing, and romantic city that is easy to love. It's a world capital for art, fashion, food, literature, ideas, and it stands as a symbol of everything fine civilization has to offer. How can you not love a city whose oldest cafe opened in 1686, almost a century before the founding of the USA? And cuisine? Paris has more Michelin-rated restaurants than any city in the world. The Parisians even have a baguette law. And as for haute couture, Paris is home to three of the five top global makers of luxury fashion, such as Louis Vuitton, Hermes, and Cartier, as well as the world's largest cosmetics company, L'Oreal. The history, monuments, museums, all of them contribute to a general Parisian vibe that is unmistakable. And in 2019, there were over 35 million tourist arrivals picking up on that vibe. That's about the entire population of Canada. Today, we're going to tell the story of Paris. And as we go along, we'll touch on the top 10 things to do when visiting the city. If you lose track, we'll give you a summary when we wrap things up at the end. And maybe we'll even figure out how Paris became known as the City of Light. And we're going to get down into the Parisian sewers. So how did it all start? People have been living along the banks of the Seine River as far back as 8,000 BCE. A Celtic subgroup known as the Parisii occupied the region around 250 BCE until they were defeated by the Romans, led by generals like Julius Caesar. You might remember the famous statement, Veni, Vidi, Vici, I came, I saw, I conquered. It was Gaul, or France, that he was talking about. The Romans took the city, but at least they kept the name, as Paris derives from the Parisii people. But Romans did what Romans do. They started building enormous structures, like an amphitheater that could seat up to 15,000 spectators. And they built an aqueduct, which supplied the massive Roman bath, the Thermes de Cluny. And you can still visit this today. The prime bit of real estate in this fledgling city, though, was an island in the middle of the Seine River, which is simply named the City Island, or Île de la Cité. It seemed like the perfect place to build a temple, which they did, and they dedicated it to the god Jupiter. Christianity was later introduced to Paris, and in the middle of the 3rd century CE, Denis of Paris was appointed as the first bishop of Paris. That sounds like a pretty good gig, but old Denis had a tough go of it, because according to tradition, he was arrested by a Roman prefect, and when he refused to renounce his faith, he was beheaded on Mount Mercury. This later became the Mountain of Martyrs, or Mons Martyrum, and eventually Montmartre. But Denis wasn't done. According to tradition, after his decapitation, Denis picked up his head and carried it to a secret Christian cemetery about 6 miles away. As a result, Denny became venerated and eventually beatified as a saint by the Roman Catholic Church. Today, Saint Denis is the patron saint of Paris, complete with his own feast day of October the 9th. And when you visit Paris, you are likely to see frequent depictions, paintings, and statues of a figure holding his severed head, most prominently at the entrance to the Notre Dame Cathedral. Don't wig out, it's just Saint Denis. As the Roman Empire hit the skids due to the increasing Germanic invasions of the 5th century, Paris went into a period of decline. A tribe called the Franks eventually took control, turning Paris into a French city. And by the 12th century, it had become the largest city in all of Europe. A fortified rectangular castle was built, complete with four towers and a moat. It was called the Louvre. The first university in Europe was also established on the left bank of the Seine River in the year 1200. Thousands of students, scholars, monks, all flocked to the University of Paris from England, Germany, Italy, and other places. And because Latin was the language of instruction at the university and the common language in which the foreign students could converse, the university district on the left bank became known as the Latin Quarter. It became a bumping, vibrant place and has maintained that vibe right up until the present day, with lots of bistros and restaurants to explore. It's got a jumping atmosphere and tons of student life. And here's another first. On the exact location on the Ile de la Cité, where the Roman temple to Jupiter was built, construction began in the year 1163 on a new cathedral, which was built in a revolutionary style. It was called Gothic. The cathedral would be called Our Lady of Paris. You will know it as Notre Dame. This iconic building shattered the conventions of the day and set the standard for cathedrals for all time. It is one of the most widely recognized symbols of the city of Paris and of the French nation. This status is so important to France that there is a plate on a square in front of the church engraved with a compass, which is known as point zero, where all distances in France are measured from. Now, here's what makes Notre Dame so innovative. The prevailing style of architecture at that time was known as Romanesque, which featured round arches, sturdy pillars, and barrel vaults. Thick walls were required to support the massive weight of the roof, so windows were small, making the interiors dark and dreary. Well, Notre Dame introduced a game-changing innovation, flying buttresses. Now, I'm a bit of an architecture nerd, so indulge me while I talk about this. These graceful flying buttresses strengthened the walls, which allowed the weight of the roof to be supported outside the cathedral. Therefore, the walls could be much higher, much thinner, and they could have much larger windows, and that would allow the cathedral to be bathed in light. The result was that these clever medieval architects were able to install three massive, glorious rose windows, the largest of which is almost 13 meters or 40 feet in diameter. It's really quite mesmerizing to see this. Add to that the pointed arches as opposed to the Romanesque rounded ones, rib vaults, towers, spires, and dozens of half-man, half-beast gargoyles that were used as water drains, and you've got quite a beautiful and interesting and unique building. But there's more to this cathedral than architecture. In order to be a self-respecting cathedral, you had to have some holy relics, which would give the place some stature, where medieval believers might want to make a pilgrimage to worship. Notre Dame hit a home run when French King Louis IX was able to purchase at great expense some high-profile alleged relics from the Passion of Christ, including the crown of thorns, a nail from the cross, and for good measure, he also got a sliver of the cross. So you've got your innovative architecture, your gorgeous windows, your sacred relics. Notre Dame also has an awesome collection of 10 bells, the largest of which weighs almost 13,000 kilograms. That's nearly 30,000 pounds. Notre Dame may not be the biggest cathedral in Europe, but it could be the most beautiful. and it certainly represents the essence of classic Gothic architecture. In recent years, approximately 13 million people per year will visit Notre Dame, making it the most visited monument in Paris. However, as you probably know, in April of 2019, the roof of Notre Dame caught fire and burned for around 15 hours. It looked horrific, and it was, and the cathedral sustained serious damage. But some would say it was really almost miraculously saved. Reconstruction has begun, and the French government hopes that it can all be completed by the spring of 2024 in time for the opening of the 2024 Summer Olympics in Paris. When you go there today, you can still get wonderful views of the cathedral from across the Seine, but there's nothing like going inside, ascending onto the balconies and to the bell towers. I hope you get a chance to do this, because with all due respect to the Eiffel Tower, I would have to say that Notre Dame Cathedral is probably the most historic and iconic symbol of France. Well, let's jump forward and see what's happening in Paris in the 17th century. The city was prosperous and growing with a population of about 400,000. Each new king of France had added buildings, bridges, and fountains to embellish his capital, and most of them were in the new Renaissance style that was being imported from Italy. Remember that Louvre fortress I mentioned earlier that was built in medieval times? It was completely overhauled and renovated to become the official residence of the French king. Adjacent to the Louvre, you have the Jardin des Tuileries, which was built by the French queen consort, Catherine de' Medici, in the Renaissance style of her native Florence. You'll undoubtedly encounter this gorgeous garden oasis as you explore the city. Then along came the Sun King, Louis XIV. Due to some revolts against the monarchy, he didn't really feel comfortable in Paris, so he moved to a hunting lodge about a one-day's walk outside the city. He didn't want to have to worry about mobs sneaking up on him. But this wasn't any old hunting lodge. It was transformed into the most spectacular residence on the planet, the Palace of Versailles. Even though this is a 25-kilometer trek from the center of the city, I think it really qualifies as a Paris attraction and makes for a great day trip. There's yet another iconic site you might want to fit into your visit. But we have to mention King Louis because he really made a mark on Paris, even if he did leave Paris. Under his reign, much was built in the city, including theaters, boulevards, spectacular squares, and Les Invalides, which is a military hospital slash church complex, which today houses the French Military History Museum and the Tomb of Napoleon. I visited both, and seriously, they're both fantastic attractions that are really worth seeing. And one more legacy from Louis XIV. At the time, there was quite a bit of crime in Paris, and Louis was determined to restore the public's faith in law and order. Now, crime, as you might expect, was most rampant at night. That's when lawmakers would find it easier to evade police down dark alleys. So Louis tried to address this by installing more lighting. Lanterns were placed on almost every main street, and residents were asked to light their windows with candles and oil lamps. The city was alight. It worked, and crime was reduced. And from then on, Paris gained the nickname La Ville Lumière, which is the City of Light. So that is how Paris got its nickname. Another very Parisian characteristic was established in 1686. In the University District of the Latin Quarter, Le Procope opened, and that was the first cafe in the Western world. It spawned an entire culture in the city. 14 years later, in the year 1700, there were more than 300 cafes, and by 1789, at the time of the French Revolution, it had exploded to more than 1,800. This is significant for a couple of reasons. These cafes were integral to the start of the French Revolution, as they were ground zero for what became known as the Age of Enlightenment, when people met to complain and bounce around ideas about better ways to run the country and the government, All of this planted the seeds of revolution. Le Procope was a favorite hangout of many French philosophers, such as Voltaire, Rousseau, and others, and principal leaders of the revolution, Maximilien Robespierre, Georges Danton, and Jean-Paul Marat. All of those guys were regulars at Procope. Café society became a major part of Parisian life, and in later years, all kinds of free thinkers congregated in cafés. People like Balzac, Émile Zola, Victor Hugo, Salvador Dali, Pablo Picasso, how about Vladimir Lenin and Leon Trotsky, Ernest Hemingway, James Joyce, Albert Einstein, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Jean-Paul Sartre, all of them were devoted to café culture. It was and still is where people meet to do business, entertain friends, have political discussions, or romantic interludes. Drop into Le Procope when you're exploring the Latin Quarter or some other renowned cafes in the area like Les Deux Magots or Café de Fleury. Enjoy a coffee and a light meal and watch Parisian life walk by. It's a very Parisian thing to do. Another development around this time period was the construction of a new boulevard, which is known as the Champs-Élysées. It was laid out to align with the Louvre and the Tuileries Garden. For centuries, Parisians have strolled from the Louvre, wandered through the Jardin des Tuileries, and they emerged from there at the Place de la Concorde, which is where King Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette were executed during the French Revolution. The guillotine is now gone, and in its place is a big old 3,000-year-old obelisk that was brought in from Egypt. From there, the stroll continues onto the Champs-Élysées with its theaters, cafes, and luxury shops. And at the top of the Champs stands the iconic Arc de Triomphe, which is the triumphal arch commissioned by Napoleon Bonaparte to celebrate his military victories. This is also where the Tour de France cycling race wraps up. You can do this stroll in about 40 minutes, but it's going to take you longer than that because I'm thinking you're going to be distracted along the way. See if you agree with the French claim that the Champs-Élysées is the most beautiful avenue in the world. We've touched on the Louvre, but at last report, it was a medieval-era fortress that was converted into a royal residence. That was until Louis XIV bugged out of town to move to Versailles. So what happened with the Louvre? Well, here's the story. In 1789, the city and the country are ripe for revolution. The feckless King Louis XVI and his extravagant Austrian wife, Marie Antoinette, were both guillotined in Paris, along with 17,000 other people who lost their heads under the Reign of Terror, many at the aforementioned Place de la Concorde, where that obelisk now stands. One of the objectives of this revolution was to de-Christianize France. To that end, Notre Dame Cathedral was rededicated to the cult of reason and later to the cult of the supreme being, whatever that is. Many of the treasures of the cathedral were either destroyed or plundered. There were 28 statues of biblical kings located at the west facade of Notre Dame, but they were mistaken for statues of French kings and they were all beheaded, much like poor old Saint-Denis. A group of scholars and historians at that time period went around collecting statues and paintings from demolished churches all over Paris in an attempt to save them. And guess where they ended up? The former royal palace known as the Louvre. Now belonging to the people, the Louvre became the central museum of the arts. So there you have it. The largest, and I think it is fair to say the most well-known museum in the world was a child of the French Revolution. Now, of course, a trip to the Louvre is pretty much mandatory on your visit to Paris. Without doubt, the most famous treasure in the museum is Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa. So you're going to want to check that out when you are there. Now, the Louvre makes it easy for you to find the painting because they literally have directional arrows on the floor telling you where to find the Mona Lisa. So if you want a quiet moment with her, do not hold your breath. There will be throngs of other people who will crowd into the room with you, craning their necks to get a glimpse of this tiny portrait. It's only 30 inches high and 21 inches wide. So fair warning, it will probably be somewhat disappointing. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't see it. There is another of Leonardo da Vinci's works at the Louvre that is not as renowned as the Mona Lisa, but it's arguably even more compelling. It's called The Virgin on the Rocks. There are actually two of them. One is in the Louvre, the other one is in London. And this is really worthwhile if you want to seek that one out, and you'll have far fewer crowds there than you will crowded around the Mona Lisa. Another favorite painting of mine in the Louvre is the lavish Jacques-Louis David depiction of Napoleon Bonaparte's coronation in Notre Dame Cathedral in 1804. This is almost 10 times the size of the Mona Lisa, and there's a lot going on in this painting. It's a very good example of Napoleonic propaganda art. You'll also want to see two of the most influential and important statues in the world, the 2,200-year-old Winged Victory of Samothrace and the spectacular Venus de Milo. There's also an unbelievably impressive collection of Egyptian artifacts and a lot of mummies, which are really fun to look at. But my favorite thing to see in the Louvre is Hammurabi's stone, on which the Code of Hammurabi is etched. It comes from ancient Mesopotamia, is written in cuneiform, dates back to 1754 BCE. It is not only one of the oldest examples of written laws in the world, it is the oldest readable text ever discovered, and it's way ahead of its time. It states that people are innocent until proven guilty and contains the first written example of the phrase, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So to me, there's lots to see in the Louvre, but don't miss this. And the best thing about Hammurabi's stone is you'll probably be alone in the room when you're viewing it. And that's a rare thing when you're visiting this amazing museum. After the French Revolution, Napoleon Bonaparte emerged as the Emperor of France. After a tumultuous reign, he ended up in exile, first on the island of Elba, just off the coast of Italy, and then in St. Helena, which is an island in the middle of the Atlantic. His body was eventually returned to Paris and is entombed in a lavish sarcophagus in a regal setting at Les Invalides. This is another site worth visiting. But as we get deeper into the 19th century, Napoleon makes a comeback. Not Napoleon Bonaparte, he remained quite dead in his sarcophagus. It was his nephew, Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, who became the first elected president of France in 1848. And after winning approval in a national referendum, he became Emperor Napoleon III in 1852. His record as emperor was mixed at best, but it was not boring. At the beginning of Napoleon's reign, Paris had a population of about 1 million people, and most of them lived in crowded and unhealthy conditions. So in 1853, Napoleon III launched a gigantic public works program in an attempt to put unemployed Parisians to work and to bring clean water, light, and open space to the center of the city. The mastermind of this project was Georges Eugène Haussmann, the Minister of Public Works, who was given enormous autonomy to carry out a massive urban renewal program. Over the next 17 years, the appearance of Paris was entirely transformed. Old neighborhoods were demolished and rebuilt. Open spaces and broad, straight boulevards were added. Strict standards were imposed on the stately new buildings that were built along these boulevards. All of them were 5 stories tall. All of them had angled black slate roofs and formal facades. These standards gave central Paris the elegantly uniform street plan and distinctive look that it still retains today. Not only that, but new street lamps, kiosks, omnibus stops, and public toilets, which are called chalets of necessity, I love that, these were all installed, and they were specially designed by the city architect, which would give the Paris boulevards their distinct harmony and their look. Would you like to be transported back 150 years to get that quintessential view of Haussmann's Paris? Here's how you do that. Visit the pedestrian island in front of the Opera Garnier, which was actually built for Napoleon III in 1875. If you look around a 360-degree view from there, You're looking at Paris circa 1875, when it was the capital of the world. I've done this, and it's really cool to transport yourself back to the Paris of George Eugene Haussmann. It's the iconic Paris, the historical Paris of your imagination. But if you want another decidedly unique view of Paris, I have an offbeat suggestion that I teased off at the start of this episode, and it probably isn't on your radar. I'd like to send you to the sewer. Part of the Haussmann makeover was the construction of a new sewer system with underground tunnels for both drinking water and wastewater. Hundreds of miles of tunnels were hollowed out, forming a network below the surface, which mirrored the one above, right down to the street signs. Street signs above the surface, right below street signs in the tunnels. If you've read the Victor Hugo book, Les Miserables, or more likely you've perhaps seen the musical Les Miserables, you might be familiar with the famous scene where Javert confronts Jean Valjean in the sewers. This was so popular, it sparked an interest in the sewers of Paris, and the first sewer tours were offered way back in 1889. At that time, you traveled around in carriages pulled by a locomotive, and later you could even take a boat trip through the sewer system. Now, I have done this tour, and I found it fantastic, and it's not even all that stinky. So if you want to switch gears from all of the high culture of Paris, you can mix it up by making a visit to the literal underbelly of the city. You won't be sorry that you did. So I've got you going to a sewer, so why not keep going? I'd also like to send you to a cemetery. In 1804, Napoleon Bonaparte commissioned the establishment of the Père Lachaise Cemetery. This cemetery got a huge boost when the remains of a renowned medieval theologian, Pierre Abelard, and his lover Heloise were transferred there in the year 1817. After this great event, everyone was dying to get into Père Lachaise. You'll have to excuse that lame joke there. It continued to grow to its present size of 110 acres, making it not only the largest cemetery, but also the largest park in Paris. It has over 1 million bodies buried there and an incredible 3.5 million visitors annually, making it the most visited necropolis in the world. So it's a large cemetery, it's very scenic, it's overflowing with impressive graves and mausoleums and monuments, but that's not why the 3.5 million visitors go every year. It's to pay their respects to some of the luminaries who are buried there. A few of the big names there are Oscar Wilde, Frédéric Chopin, Sarah Bernhardt, Edith Piaf, and the famous mime Marcel Marceau. While I'm doing lame jokes, one that you'll hear is how Marcel Marceau wins the award for the longest running act doing the classic mime gag, being trapped in a box. Sorry about that. Journalist Victor Noir is buried there. You've probably never heard of him, but he has a prostrate likeness of himself on top of his grave. And old Victor has a curiously large bulge in his pants, and has become tradition for those who wish to get pregnant to touch this bulge for good luck. But the most visited grave of all in the cemetery is that of the frontman of the Doors, Jim Morrison. He died in Paris of a drug overdose. Pilgrims come daily to leave messages, flowers, or poems. I've only been to Père Lachaise once, but I can personally attest to this phenomenon because when I was there, I saw a small gathering in front of his grave upon my visit. So I'm not even a Doors guy, and I paid a visit. So I guess I helped to make this the most visited grave in the cemetery. Okay, maybe we won't end our story of Paris at a sewer or at a graveyard. Let's wrap up with the Belle Époque, which is loosely translated as the beautiful era. This took place from 1871 to 1914, the start of World War I. Now, the Franco-Prussian War between France and Germany ended in 1871. There was a feeling that the nation needed to atone for the abuses that were committed during this war. So in 1873, Parisians turned to Montmartre, the Mountain of Martyrs overlooking the city. Remember, that's where old Saint Denis, the patron saint of Paris, lost his head. Here, the Basilica of the Sacred Heart, or Sacré-Cœur, was built, and it has become one of the most recognizable landmarks in Paris. And the Montmartre area became a center for artists and bohemians who revolutionized the Paris art scene with entirely new art forms, expressionism, fauvism. Basically, you could say that Montmartre was the birthplace of modern art. Let's run down a list of artists who have lived and worked in Montmartre. Claude Monet, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, Edgar Degas, Henri Matisse, Henri Toulouse-Lautrec, Vincent van Gogh, Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and others. And these bohemians knew how to party. Montmartre is in the Pigalle district of Paris, which is home to the legendary Moulin Rouge Cabaret, which is where the can-can was invented. It's been nicknamed the first palace of women, and it helped to solidify Paris's international reputation as a center of decadent pleasure. Incidentally, it was the first building in Paris to have electricity, which added to its reputation as Paris being the city of light. Today, Montmartre is an officially designated historic district. Development is limited to allow it to maintain its character. And what a great place to wander and explore. Montmartre has wonderful outdoor cafes, street artists, great shopping, and spectacular views of Paris from the steps of the Sacré-Cœur Cathedral. You'll also find the Salvador Dali Museum there, not far from the address where he once lived. And if you don't mind an expensive, although perhaps a bit touristy, night out, check out the Moulin Rouge Cabaret for their legendary can-can show. And as the name suggests, Montmartre is elevated above the city, and although it's not really fair to call it a mountain, there are some steep steps you can walk up, and if you don't feel like walking those steep steps, there's an inclined railway or funicular that will take you there. Spend an evening in Montmartre. It's probably my favorite place in Paris. While I hope you visit Montmartre, I know there is one Parisian landmark that you will visit, which I've barely mentioned in this podcast. In the second half of the 19th century, Paris hosted 5 international expositions. They attracted millions of visitors. It made Paris an increasingly important center of technology, trade, and tourism. The first of these universal expositions was in 1885, hosted by Napoleon III himself. It was designed to showcase the achievements of French industry and culture. But it was the Universal Exposition of 1889 that would make the biggest impression on Paris. In 1887, French civil engineer Gustave Eiffel was given a commission to build the tower in preparation for the 1889 exposition. This was an awesome engineering feat. The biggest obstacle really was building the foundation. The soil was too muddy to support the big pillars that would be required. Now, Gustave Eiffel had built many bridges, so he drew on this experience, which required support piers to be constructed underwater. He sank heavy bottomless compartments, or caissons, into the wet soil. These were watertight, and they were injected with breathable air, very ingenious, so workers could dig out the mud from beneath them, and they would allow the caissons to sink even further. When the workers were done, the hole was filled with cement 20 feet thick and capped with stone. The massive iron pillars were sunk into the ground at an angle, anchored in a subterranean stone. It took 300 workers 2 years to assemble 18,000 iron beams that were hammered together by 2.5 million red-hot rivets made on-site by blacksmiths. And when it was completed on May 15, 1889, it soared to 1,000 feet high, ruling as the tallest structure in the world, surpassing the Washington Monument, which is a little more than half as high, and that one had taken 36 years to build. To build the Eiffel Tower, it took all the ingenuity that the industrial age had to offer: mass production, cutting-edge technology, and capitalist funding. And as iconic as the Eiffel Tower is today, it was not popular with everyone at the time. It had this modernistic style that was denounced by many of France's most prominent cultural figures. They thought it was garish and ugly. And amazingly, after all of the effort they went to construct the thing, it was only supposed to be a temporary structure, and they had plans to dismantle the tower in 20 years. Thankfully, it grew on people. And although my vote might go to the Notre Dame Cathedral, you can certainly argue that nothing symbolizes the city as much as the Eiffel Tower. So are you going to go up to the top of the Eiffel Tower? Of course you will. It's crowded, it's expensive, and there are probably better views of Paris. But this is an eye-popping, once-in-a-lifetime, I've-been-there experience. And you can join the exclusive club, the club of a quarter of a billion people who have visited the Eiffel Tower, making it the most visited paid monument in the world. Well, we breezed through about 2,000 years of Parisian history, and of course, we've left an awful lot out. So let's wrap up by highlighting the main sights and attractions we've talked about that you may want to consider on your next visit to the City of Light to get the most out of your experience. Start with the no-brainers. Your top three will be the Louvre, the Eiffel Tower, and Notre Dame Cathedral. You'll also love doing the walk from the Louvre through the Tuileries Gardens, the Place de la Concorde, up to the Champs-Élysées, and the Arc de Triomphe. An evening overlooking Paris from the steps of the Sacré-Cœur while you're exploring the bohemian neighborhood of Montmartre is time well spent. Get into the cafe culture in the Latin Quarter. Drop into Le Procope and People Watch while you enjoy a croissant and sip on a cappuccino. Make a day trip to visit the stunning palace and the gardens of Versailles. And how about the Père Lachaise Cemetery? And don't forget the sewers. Paris, the city of light, city of romance, city of sewers. There's a lot to choose from. Your travels in Europe will not be complete until you visit Paris. I hope you make it there. Jump onto my Instagram, Snapshots Travelog, for a few pictures of some of these Paris highlights we've covered in this episode. And while you're there, feel free to leave a comment. And until next time, keep calm and travel on.